I think one of the things that made it so interesting, as I say, was the fact that I had this excellent support from Pratt and Edwards, and Jimmy Pratt was a pragmatist, and you know, the Pakanady wasn't part of it,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that the trials had to be done, do them. You have to cut a few corners or change a few things that the Navy's always done.
Right.
Change them. You know.
Okay.
We went from sail to steam.
I had a couple of other questions as it related to the trials. What would be sort of the normal steaming? How many knots would you be doing when you were going to be doing a recovery?
Depended a bit on the sea state, and depended a bit on the wind. And there was a certain, I've forgotten what the thing was, there was a certain window, you might say, a wind across the deck and rolling it.
It was
acceptable, but I've forgotten what those things were. It's a long time ago.
So the ship would be steaming into the wind about 15 degrees off?
As I recall, basically that. So it was a bit of wind cover, and also by going into the wind, usually we're going into the sea too,
mm-hmm.
so to reduce the rolling
all right.
as much as possible, and just got on with it.
So there'd be maybe 20 knots of wind or 25 over the deck,
depending on what we were steaming at, and that we tried not to reverse course too much. But they say we were doing it as an operational trial. We weren't doing it under war conditions where we had to steam certain courses and we had to keep certain speeds up. That was not part of it. That was the next stage.
Mm-hmm.
We were just interested in the physical ability to bring the helicopter on board under varying conditions, wind and sea.
Do you remember any of the pilots expressing any concern about turbulence that may have been generated from the funnels?
No.
So it was primarily turbulence coming around from the wind
coming around the hangar. The only thing I recall is that the funnels were changed. And if I recall, that they were too short when we started off, and they had to elongate them to get the funnel gases further up before they were put out in the atmosphere. But that's a bit of a hazy recollection.
Right. So, what were your impressions of Assiniboine's seakeeping qualities, as you say, with the superstructure of the hangar there, particularly in the heavy weather that you got
into? I didn't
into.
Notice that much of a change. You know, when you're in a ship in heavy weather, you say, I hope to God the designers have taken all this into account. No, you just had a trust, you had a good vehicle, no problems to date, and so you just got on with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can remember in the carriers a watchkeeper coming home one time, and we had green water over the flight deck, and we cracked some steel I-beams up under the flare. And you do a few things like that, you realize the power of the waves and the sea. And just bearing that in mind, you tend to try and work with it, not against it.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's all you can say, you know, sea sense, I guess you might say.
So did Assiniboine go on any deployments that weren't considered local?
I took her over to England once to show the Brits, and we did some demonstrations over there for them. And well, it was a bit of R&R, too, in a sense, that the ship's company, even though Halifax hadn't gone anywhere, done anything. So it was sort of ordered, felt all around it would be a good thing to go abroad, go to Britain, try some flight training, or some trials on the way across and back, and show the Brits what we had.
So I assume that Assiniboine would have been steaming with the carrier?
No, we were on our own.
You were on your own?
Yep.
So there was no alternative landing platform if required?
No, mind you, we were fairly, we tried our best not to do any flying when we were outside the helicopter range of a shore base.
Oh, really?
Well, this was sort of in the back of our minds all the time. I don't think we ever got down and measured things out, but, you know, we said, hey, you know, this is no place to try that.
That's interesting, because I've never seen that in the documents anywhere.
No, well,
I assume that if they had the opportunity to get the boat
okay,
along.
If it's good weather,
mm-hmm.
in the middle Atlantic on our own, fine, we do it.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't go and stretch the envelope any more than we had to, because we felt we had caused any damage to the helicopter or loss of the helicopter or anything like that. It would be a black eye for the program and everything else. We wanted that program to finish and finish well.
So on when you were steaming for the UK, and while you were within range of shore base for the helicopter on either the western Atlantic or eastern Atlantic, did you encounter any heavier weather than you had up around Newfoundland? Or was
nothing rings a bell, you know, that sticks in my mind as having been out of the ordinary. We were just carrying on doing the trials and did them, I guess.
Now that you're steaming to the UK, and you've got the aircraft handlers, you've got the pilots, you've got the scientists, you've got various VX-10 personnel, was it pretty cramped aboard for accommodations and messing and all that sort of thing?
It was a bit, but don't forget the ship was designed to take in a small contingent to run the helicopter, and I don't recall any problems developing out of it. I don't think we had many people sleeping in the wardroom proper. I think we had cabins for and proper accommodation for everybody. I think we must have, because I don't recall even having to give up my spare cabin to anybody. You know, that used to be a sort of thing that
right.
if you had brass on board or as a captain, because he had his sea cabin sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Underway, and that meant his main cabin was open, and I don't recall ever having putting up anybody extra.
So when you got to the UK, what was the reaction of the Royal Navy to bear trap and landing such a heavy helicopter aboard a small
well,
destroyer?
Well, the trouble was that to me and also for the Royal Navy were gentlemen of the First Order, and the Empire is everything, and I think that they were a little nonplussed that Canada would come up with something good and efficient like this.
The colony showing up, the mother country?
That was just an impression I got. You know, we had a lot of interest, a lot of people came down, maybe it was a day away from the office from Admiralty, I don't know, but we had a lot of people down for the day. I don't know how many times I had to lunch all the brass, visiting brass.
The RN was working on a similar sort of haul down, except they were using a harpoon and grid on their flight deck, which, from what I have understand of the process, created all sorts of problems for releasing the aircraft in order for takeoff.
I don't know about the British thing at all. I didn't get into it. It's interesting, though, because Ferry Aviation, of course, it was a British origin company, but the people that did the bear trap.
Right.
And one of their chief scientists lived two doors away from me in Dartmouth. And I think that was another thing that upset the Brits a bit. You know, Ferry Aviation was doing this in Canada, not letting the Brits get the kudos for it.
Was that individual that you refer to that was in Ferry Aviation, was that a Mr. Martin?
No.
Does that name ring a bell?
No, not mine. I can't think of the name now.
But he was one of the chief engineers?
He could have been, but it was the same. There just so many people went through there. It was like a revolving door to supermarket.
What other memorable things stand out for you as CEO of Assiniboine during this trial period?
Basically, I think it was the fact that here was something non-traditional, and we got on with it and achieved it because we had good people supporting us from the top. And, you know, Nelson didn't do it this way, so we won't try it. We didn't have any of that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very enlightening thing. It's the way I tended to think, because I wasn't a permanent force Royal Navy trained guy that tradition is everything. I just felt that Canada had an idea and had the guts to go ahead and try it out, and it worked. And our job is to get it past all acceptance levels so we could go to sea with it. And we did.
Do you feel that some people have argued that having a helicopter embarked on the ship was sort of a wooding of the armament of the destroyer? Did you ever view it that way, personally?
Yeah. No. Well, I was an anti-submarine specialist, not a gunnery specialist, and the anti-submarine side of it, which we were supposed to be building up for, because we weren't in a gunnery support system like there were in Vietnam and places like that. We were anti-submarine warfare. That was our credo. We made our name on it during the Second World War, and here was an idea to get in the keep in the forefront, and we did.
Nearing the end of the trials, was there any discussion at all whether Assiniboine would continue with the heavy weather and night trials, or was that a foregone conclusion that she had to go in for her refit to enlarge the hangar and let Annapolis take over?
I've forgotten. Because I turned over to Tom Everett, and I lost track of things. I went to England after to do staff college, so I lost track of what was going on after I left.
How would you view your time on the trials, looking back at it now, 30 years later, in terms of level of cooperation and ability of people to get on with the job?
Well, I had the feeling that right from the word go that the people were behind it and we got support bloody near everywhere. I can't think of anyone that sort of stood in the way of getting on with the bloody trials. And, you know, I stuck my neck out, other people stuck their necks out, we got the thing done. That was our job.
When you say stuck your neck out, is it anything that you can specifically remember?
Well, you know, looking for rough weather trials off Newfie there. Okay, what would have happened if the thing had crashed?
Mm-hmm.
Gone in. Maybe buggered up one of my props enough so I couldn't maneuver. There was no standby.
Right.
For us, you know, at least with a the carrier, you have the air sea rescue destroyer sitting off her stern there in case of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, maybe you could say our necks were stuck out, but on the other hand, heck, any skipper got his neck out when he's gone to sea. So I just felt that it was the job was there, the job was to be done, and we were going to do it.
And there was that flexibility built into the whole program?
Yeah, flexibility and understanding. I think that's a big thing. We did a number of things that were not necessarily right by the book.
And that was just one example?
You know, getting people like Jim Pratt and Edwards, Commodore Edwards, Captain Edwards, was saying, getting their support and saying, okay, if that's what you want to do, Walter, go ahead.
Now, we're just going to back...
Shell was the same. Shell was... You know, we had our arguments, sure, but, you know, that's... I mean, that's the nature of things. If everything goes swimmingly, it's a problem.
Now, I'm just going to backtrack here for a moment. You said that you had served in Magnificent, is that correct?
Yeah.
And in what capacity?
I was a staff, or the TAS officer, Tributary and Submarine Officer there. I took over from Pete Cayley. And Dyer was the captain, and he left, and Harry Porter being his sort of staff officer. And then Harry left, and Admiral Rayner came down, Commodore Rayner came down to take command, and they made me the staff officer, which was good fun.
So do you think that your time in Magnificent meant that you were perhaps a little bit more open-minded about this whole concept of matching a heavy helicopter to a destroyer than perhaps
a cadet entry and coming up the old traditional lines, I think I was a little more open-minded. Don't know, I think I was. And having people like Dyer and then Rayner, who was a stickler, but a practical stickler.
Mm-hmm.
I got to you got to be able to talk to the aviators. You see, you know, Staticona and Shearwater were different. They're different sides of the harbor. They had their own social lives. And working lives, you know, if you got into the carrier, fine, but a lot of the people never served in the carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you did, some of the areas of carrier work were the same as anywhere else. If you're in the engine room, you're in the engine room. maybe a little bigger engines than the other. But you know, that thing, the RPs, you plotted in the office room, you did that, but you did the same in the destroyer, the same in the carrier, just the carriers was a bit bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So you tended to lead your own lives. And I mean, I got to know the airmen on the carrier and realized they were human beings too. No, that's not very kind. But they were different, and more power to them.
So when did you turn over Assiniboine then? Were you in command right until she went into refit?
I turned over to her in February of whatever it was. Okay, December 1965, I turned over. And went to Staff College, and it's the 21st of December. What in the hell did Tom Hibbert come to take over from me?
Now, in late 1964, Assiniboine goes into refit to enlarge her hangar, and you are still CO. Where did she go in for that refit?
They either be the dockyard or Halifax shipyards.
And how long a process would that have
been?
Do you remember?
I took her down to St. John one time, too. What the hell did they do down there? This was our standard docking and things, stuff like that. I don't remember if that's what they did, the hangar conversion or not. I can't recall. It'll be in the report proceedings, but I can't recall which time that was.
And it would have been a few months in the dockyard in order to do that?
Yeah.
Now, you had alluded to, when you were going through your papers, that you had written up a number of recommendations that had come out of the trials. Do you remember what some of the key recommendations might have been?
No, I'm sorry, I don't.
But this would have been from an operational perspective, I assume.
Well, to try to tie the two together, because this was a much smaller, more motion-conscious flight deck than we'd had before. And so that there were some new areas that had to be looked at, and Shell and Saws orchestrated the trials program to try and make sure that we covered all of these possibilities. And I think we did. I think I don't think the trials program was carved in stone, and that's all we did. We'd go so far, we'd see something that we thought needed looking at, we'd discuss it, we'd say, okay, well, this is what we can do to check that out, and we'd do it, and we'd come back to the main program, and we'd come up another little detour, maybe. And it was just that way there. We had a job to do, and we had to get there, and sometimes something new would come up, and you had to look at it, and that's fine. You know, for instance, the funnels were different.
Mm-hmm.
We came out with one set of stacks, and then they had to change them a bit because apparently the downdraft was affecting the flying.
Right.
But that's why you do trials, to highlight these problems and resolve them.
One of the things that I could never reach a final conclusion about was the stabilizers. The naval constructors talked about a number of possible scenarios, and one of which was having fixed stabilizers. But I've been told that Assiniboine and the Saint Laurent class that embark helicopters never had fixed stabilizers. What they used was ballast tanks.
No, we had stabilizers.
You had fins.
We had fins, yeah. That's what I say. They got, you know, we cross-necked them and rocked the ship in calm water.
So these were fixed, or were they?
No, they were fins. They were fins.
All right.
Like ailerons.
Right.
Only they stuck out. Like it's like a rudder on its side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they just, if the ship was starting to go to starboard, they lift the starboard side and depress the port side.
Oh, I see. So they were maneuverable maneuverable then.
Oh yeah, they were run by hydraulic power to twist them like ailerons on an aircraft, and only they were balanced like a rudder,
because
they were rudders on their side,
right?
And they were just built in so that they could counteract anything. If the ship started to go to starboard, they correct and make sure the starboard side had lift on it.
Did they work fairly well insofar as you were concerned during the trials?
Oh, yeah. The only problem was the chiefs and petty officers hated them because they were right in the space below them and thump, 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 thump.
Oh, really?
Yes, I would try to get some sleep.
So it made a substantial difference. But I'm would the stabilizers only be effective in certain sea states, though?
We didn't have to use them that often, as I recall. And I think that they passed satisfactorily for what they were designed to do and what the criteria was. I never heard anything pro or con. It was just one of the changes that had been made to try and get the ship ready for flying station flying, and that was it.
I had read somewhere that the Saint Laurent class had a high degree of roll or a tendency to roll. So can one assume that the stabilizers helped in that regard?
They would have reduced that criterion, but I never felt the ship, you know, because we didn't use, because of the noise that these bloody things made, we didn't use them.
Mm-hmm.
On steaming past or anything like that. You only use them when we were at flying stations. So, and also don't forget, if you start using those things there, you slow your speed down.
All right, increased drag.
Drag, yeah. So I tended not to use them. I don't think I ever used them other than for flying trials.
During the trials themselves, something that was new for those in a destroyer was having to deal with avgas and storage and fueling operations. Does that present any sort of problems during the trials?
No, and I feel very, very guilty about one thing there. I couldn't do some of the fuel trials that had to be, and they were a low down on the priority list. So we, Nipigon, Don Saxon, was going to England, and so, as I recall, because I couldn't do the trials, everything other than the flying trials were considered more important, it was decided that he would do something about the aviation stuff, and that was fine. Only the tank they used was right below a mystic. And one of the inspection ports, tank top, wasn't screwed down absolutely tight. And as the ship rolled, the fumes at the top of the tank were forced out into the mystic.
Oh, boy.
And somebody came down with a cigarette, and boom.
Oh, really?
There were two or three people killed. This is over on the English side of the channel. This is Don Saxon.
Mm-hmm.
And he had Nipigon. I've forgotten, anyway.
So that would have been 65, 66?
Yeah, it was the time we were doing our trial, but he was, built that way, and so they decided to let him do that trial. And I was very sorry that, we hadn't foreseen this as a problem,
mm-hmm.
and we were more interested in the upper deck stuff, the flying side, and I was very, very sorry that Don had this accident. So Don Saxon, D.R. Saxon, he's out here somewhere, I think. Yeah, and he might tell you something about that particular incident. They've made some changes on the tank tops from then on, better ventilation, so this didn't happen.
During your time as CO during these trials, were there any injuries or mishaps with all the cables that kept breaking during the early part of the trials that you can remember?
Not that I can recall. It was a trials program, so you expect certain things to
go
develop and hopefully you've pre-planned as many things out of it as the system as you can, but you can't do everything. Or it's most unlikely you can do everything, so no, I just got on with what happened and got repairs made or whatever it had to be done and got on with, ready for the next series.
Did the engineer officer aboard Assiniboine spend a great deal of time assisting VX-10 and the operational test evaluation people?
I can't recall either Jerry Dawes or Johnson, the second DO, doing anything other than the normal things with them. It never raised its head as a problem area.
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, I was very, very fortunate in that the people I had in the ship believed in getting on with the job, and not like one engineer officer I had who had to sign the book every time I did anything, you know. He wanted to keep his ass clear.
So,
but the people I had, all of them on the ship, as far as I was concerned, they said, we've got the trials to do, that's our objective, for get on with it and do it. Let's not think of reasons why not.
when you sat down with the various departments and the squadron VX-10 at the end of the day, following the completion of a successful or unsuccessful trial, for that matter, and the report was being written and it was sent to Ottawa or sent to Shearwater or sent to Halifax. Was this a daily occurrence that you would sit down at the end of each day?
I don't recall it being that critical. We'd have a trials agenda established, and then it was got a bit flexible as you went along. You'd say, hey, there's something developing here that we hadn't foreseen.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the technical people come up with these things and say, hey, there's something over here we're not a little happy with. We don't want to do another couple of days with this, and that was fine. We built it into the system. We were allowed flexibility, and we used it to the best extent possible. Because, as I say, our fundamental objective is to get the bloody thing done. And that was the credo, I guess, of everybody in the squadron, in the ship, and on the admiral staff in support of it.
So if something did come up during the trials and a report was being written, just for my benefit primarily, you would be obviously in attendance. Would your XO and your EO be there as well?
It depended on what the criteria was. The XO, no. He's looking after the ship and the ship's husbandry and stuff like that. Very efficient, good guy too, Harry Rusk. And it was mainly the engineer officer who would be with us because of the impact on the engineers. But we also had, the AE guy from VX-10, he was Peter Trouble.
Mm-hmm.
He was the main guy with the hauled out and that sort of thing. So he was the whipping boy, you might say. Most of those things came in his area.
Right.
If it impinged on the rest of the ship, that's when Jerry Dawes, my EO again. But if it had to do with the flight deck equipment,
mm-hmm.
that was Peter Charlton and VX-10.
All right.
So that. And then Ferry Aviation, of course, being the prime contractor, and, you know, very often they come up and say, well, look, we can't go to sea tomorrow because I've got to get this done, or we want to go to sea and start to try something out, so I'd get the facts together and get up to see the admiral and say, this is what, well, the operations people say, this is what we want to do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They say, sure, so I go down and send an official message, you know, and get approval, and away we go.
Right.
Do it.
Now, this is just a minor point, perhaps, but I know that during the Buckingham trials, for example, they had a D&D photographer there taking still photographs and movies. Do you remember a photographer being attached during the Assiniboine trials?
No, because the flight deck aspect of it is they were basically controlled by VX-10, and I don't know who they brought down.
Right.
We go to sea with different
people,
different groups that they would bring down. And our object was to provide a platform for them to do what they had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't conscious of a photographer specifically there for any of it, but I do know that there was a much higher use of photography in the trials than in the old days.
Mm-hmm. All right.
It was all instruments.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add as it relates to the trials during your time? Any sort of final comments?
No, just the main thing was the wonderful spirit of cooperation that there seemed to be all around, and partly I think that was because the air arm, and particularly VX-10 and Captain Edwards, they were pragmatic and, you know, get on with it. Don't let tradition stand in the way. And that suited me. And
right.
That coincided with my feelings on this program, so we were just lucky and got on with it. And as I say, the two engineer officers I had, Jerry Dawes and Johnson, they were absolutely super in their kind of support that they were able to
mm-hmm.
generate. And, they, you know, the upper deck was fine, too, but they didn't have too much to do. with the trials. They were mainly, you know, the standard ops room and engine room and, you know, propulsion side of it, and we just got on with it.
Mm-hmm.
We also had one of the early variable depth sonars on the ship, so we had to take people out and show them that too.
Right.
And I went, lost a body one day by being stupid. We don't put that on. I got my knuckles wrapped for that and rightly so.
Well, thank you very much for taking part in this this afternoon.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Interested to see the final results.